Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we check in with the Great Lakes National Cemetery in Holly. It hosted an unaccompanied veteran ceremony this morning.
So now, in perpetuity, they'll be with their brothers and sisters in arms, well taken care of.
But first, anyone who wants health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, it's time. The 2019 enrollment period for the ACA runs until December 15th. It has been 5 years now since the ACA was rolled out. Let's talk about what the law known as Obamacare has meant here in Michigan as we welcome Richard Hirth. He's professor and chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Dr. Hirth, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, great big broad question to start out. How have you seen the Affordable Care Act affect public health in our state?
It certainly has increased access to care, particularly through the Healthy Michigan program, which was Michigan's Medicaid expansion. There we have about 700,000 enrollees, so that's about 7% of the population of the state right there, plus another 300,000 or so through what's known as the Obamacare exchanges. So about a 10% of the population roughly has gained coverage. It's also improved the financial position of our hospitals as the amount of uncompensated care has gone down pretty dramatically.
How does that compare, this level of coverage, with where you expected when this all began 5 years ago?
Well, it turns out it's not that different than what would have been expected. And the reason for that is Michigan was one of the states that did take up the Medicaid expansion once it became optional after the Supreme Court 2012 decision. So if we look nationally, the decrease in the uninsurance rate has not been as big as projected. But a big part of that difference is that a lot of large states, particularly like Texas and Florida, that have very large uninsured populations that would have qualified for Medicaid expansion, didn't take up. Kind of a secondary factor is that the mandate and the tax penalties that were implemented with it for people who didn't have coverage didn't end up being quite as effective as projected. And that would have affected Michigan as well. So I think that's one area where some of the projections didn't quite come to pass because it was expected that the tax penalty would be a little bit more motivating in getting coverage. And there was still a pretty substantial number of people, particularly younger, healthier people, who said, you know what, I'll just pay the penalty because that's a lot cheaper than buying coverage.
That big debate in 2013 about whether to expand Medicaid, that argument against it was going to be a financial burden that the state could not afford. How do you assess that argument now with 5 years of data to look at?
I'd say that argument really didn't hold a lot of water, partly because the federal share of the expansion was 90% even going forward when fully implemented. It started at 100%. And then there are two other factors. One, it brings in then a lot of money to, say, Michigan hospitals and providers. And the second is that some of the people who were on the expansion kind of got taken off other parts of the Medicaid program and saved the state some money in that regard, where the state share is much higher than the share under the Obamacare expansion.
So knowing that in 2020, those federal subsidies for the Medicaid expansion, as you mentioned, will decrease to 90%. States are supposed to pick up the remaining 10%. How much should we worry about that becoming a serious fiscal problem?
I'd say as long as it stays at 90%, I wouldn't be too concerned, both because of the federal dollars coming in and because of the ability to move people off other parts of the Medicaid program where our state share is more like 40% than 10%. The main concern would be that with policy, you always have the uncertainty of policy can be rewritten. And what if there's new legislation that turns the 90 into 80 or 70 or to the standard Medicaid match? So I'd say that's where there might be a fiscal concern for the state.
Where and how do you think the Affordable Care Act has fallen short in Michigan?
I'd say one of the biggest problems with the act is the subsidies for buying insurance sort of run out at 400% of the federal poverty line. Now, that's not a trivial amount of income. That's about $48,000, I believe, for an individual and about double that for a family. But if you look at how expensive individual health insurance is, if you're just above that level where the subsidies end, it is a pretty significant hit. And you know, essentially, the plan was to try to get as many people covered for as little federal money as possible so that the bill itself could kind of have a sort of neutral budgetary impact on the federal government. You know, and the way to do that is twofold. The Medicaid expansion is relatively cheap per person covered, both because the people that you're bringing in were, relatively healthy compared to the people that were sort of categorically eligible for Medicaid. And provider payments are pretty low in the Medicaid program, so that the cost per capita is not that high. And then running the subsidies out kind of limited the expenditure for the people coming in through the exchanges. So in that regard, they got as many people as they could within a sort of fixed budget. But then there are the folks who are sort of just at the, near the threshold where the subsidies run out, that if they do want to buy their coverage, if they don't get it through an employer and they do want to buy the coverage themselves, face a very hefty bill.
We're in the middle of the enrollment period, the sixth go-round for the healthcare.gov marketplace. What will you be watching most closely?
What I'd like to see is the total enrollment. If you look at the marketplace in the first 5 years, it kind of peaked in the middle year, in year three. So Michigan's enrollment went up from 14 to 15, 15 to 16, and then it went down 16 to 17 and 17 to 18. There are a couple factors that drove that, especially the 17 to 18 decrease, when the Trump administration stopped the payments for something known as the cost-sharing reduction subsidies. Insurers kind of were still required to offer these subsidies to their enrollees who qualified, but they no longer were paid the cost of providing them. Basically, it's reducing the deductibles and co-payments for people under 250% of the federal poverty line. And they still have to do that, but they're no longer paid for it. So there was a big bump in rates, kind of over 25% on average last year. Those people who got generous subsidies under the act really weren't affected. Their subsidy went up to make up for it. But again, those people that were getting little or no subsidy had to pay the full freight for that increase.
That so we did see a lot of sticker shock.
Oh, yes.
What about this year?
This year, very moderate increase, about under 2% on it for the average plan. So we saw pretty moderate increases from 14 to 17, that obviously huge bump in 18, and then back to a very moderate, I think maybe even the smallest increase we've seen on average going from 18 to 19.
What about the options people have this year when it comes to picking a health insurance plan? Because there have been some places in the state where you basically have a choice, one.
Right. So relative to a lot of other states, the Michigan marketplace is still pretty competitive. We have, I believe, 9 issuers this year, up from 8 last year. That's not as many as we had a few years ago when there were about, I think, 14 or 15 at its peak. But the ones that left tended to be the smaller players. The big players kind of stayed in. Now, there certainly are rural areas and areas in the UP where you might only have 2 issuers available. So the statewide picture doesn't necessarily apply to every locality. But there are some states that only have 1 issuer left statewide. So in that regard, Michigan is still doing pretty well.
One of the changes this year, no more penalty.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So this is maybe one area where the experts might have kind of screwed up their predictions. They thought the penalty would be a lot more effective at getting people into the exchanges than it turned out to be. But then the flip side is removing the penalty probably isn't going to be that detrimental. In a sense, the insurers are betting that way, that under 2% increase in premiums, if they were anticipating that getting rid of the penalty was going to cause a lot of their healthier enrollees to say, now I no longer have to get this coverage, they'd be increasing 5, 6, 7% this year rather than under 2%. So I think the insurers themselves kind of realized, the penalty turned out to be ineffective. But the flip side of that is removal of the penalty. That probably won't be that detrimental to offer.
And finally, Doctor, what do you see as the future of the Medicaid expansion, the future of Healthy Michigan?
So the big thing people are talking about in the future is the work requirement. So there are a number of states that have gotten work requirements in Medicaid. I think 4 of them have been approved by the federal government. And there are, I think, about 7 or so, including Michigan, that have applied. And the terms of the application say if this isn't approved or we can't negotiate some acceptable modification and get it approved, that it will sunset the program. Whether that threat occurs, it's questionable. Are we really going to want to throw 700,000 people off insurance? And the federal government is paying 90% of the cost of that insurance. So it may end up being an empty threat. That said, if it is approved, some people will be exempt from the requirement. So not everybody on Healthy Michigan Medicaid expansion will necessarily face the requirement. But those that do potentially could lose their coverage for at least a period of time.
Dr. Richard Hirth, professor and chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the U of M School of Public Health, as we mark the 5-year anniversary of the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And just a reminder again that the 2019 enrollment period runs until the 15th of December. Thanks so much, Doctor.
Glad to be here.
Still to come, after orbiting the Earth 3,152 times aboard the International Space Station, astronaut Drew Feustel is now back home.
There's just one planet that we all live on, one big round globe that we're all existing on, and you think constantly about the people down there, the people that you love, the people that you know.
That is in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to break down the weekend sports with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubakin, who tweeted late on Sunday, and I quote, "Being mad at the Lions for losing is like being mad at Canada for being cold. Rinse and repeat as needed."
All sad, all true. Here we are.
What adjectives would you use in describing that that loss to the Bears?
Sticking with the Grinch, I would go with stink, stank, stunk.
Okay.
It was epically bad football, even by Lions standards. Right now, we're into the semifinals of the state high school football, and I think eight divisions or so. If your kid plays one of these teams, or your high school does, they can block and tackle better than the Lions right now. It was pathetic. And some of the plays were so bad, they're now going viral. You know, one defensive end for the Bears knocking down two guys on the way to the quarterback, who, of course, gets sacked, Stafford.
Yes, over and over again. So here you stop and you think, Jim Caldwell nearly had the Lions in the playoffs this time ago, last year. He gets fired. Now they're 3-6 under Matt Patricia, who's taken the postgame press conference, and I quote, "Obviously, they were more ready to go than we were." All right, whose fault is this? Is it the coach? What about Bob Quinn?
Bob Quinn is the general manager, of course, who gets the players in. As Bill Parcells, the legendary old coach, used to say, only in the NFL do you have the situation where the general manager picks the groceries and the coach has got to make the dinner, which is a crazy way of doing it. Now, Quinn and Patricia should get along quite well. They're both from the New England Patriots,
right?
Same system. I think for the most part, the personnel here is not bad. And Jim Caldwell, and as you know, I was no great fan of his, but they were at least solidly mediocre, slightly better. During his run.
So you see the variable as Coach Patricia.
Right now I do. Now, you're also jammed with the Lions because you just hired the guy and for a multi-year contract and all this stuff. And if you're going to give anyone a chance, you know, you got to give them 2-3 years at least. But what is alarming is not the losing, but how they're losing. Again, the lack of basic fundamentals. I give him credit for his honesty that the Bears were more prepared than the Lions. That is completely coaching. And these are professionals. It shouldn't be that hard to get them motivated to at least play the game the right way.
Let's go over to Michigan. Let's get
happier news.
Happier news. 42-7 over Rutgers, surprising absolutely no one. So the Wolverines have won 9 straight. They're at the top of the Big Ten East. They've got to meet Indiana next weekend, and then comes the big game Ohio State. So what's the coaching challenge for keeping this team from getting out over their skis?
Exactly. Don't look ahead. Which is harder than it looks, of course, because the whole nation, your classmates, the players, of course, are in the world. The coaches are all in their bubble at Schimbeckler Hall. They're there 15 hours a day. These players are on Twitter. They're in class. They're talking to people. No one is talking about Indiana, and everyone is talking about Ohio State. That is a challenge. And Indiana, by the way, the last 10 years have played, the Hoosiers have played Michigan very well the last 10 years. Two overtime games, a couple other close calls. This is what we call a trap game. It's a booby trap because you're looking ahead, and these guys can grab your ankles. I doubt they're going to. Very focused team, a la Rutgers. You just saw it, but yeah. Watch out.
All right. And speaking of Ohio State, give us your take on just, you know, the way they beat Michigan State. What lost that game for the Spartans?
Well, first, and this compares to Michigan, is the Spartans have been banged up all year long. A ton of injuries. Almost half their starters have been out at some point.
I think he was on his fifth punter.
Well, he's fifth punter. I mean, how does that happen?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And Michigan, in contrast, has been remarkably lucky. With injuries, so
people
that makes
are
a
healthy, yeah.
Exactly that makes a huge yeah they're healthy makes a huge difference. This game, the Spartans did the hard things very well and the easy things very poorly. A lot of very stupid, unforced turnovers, including a fumble in the end zone, unforced, which allows Buckeyes to get a free touchdown.
Brian Lewerke got the start instead of Rocky Lombardi, despite being injured. Then Lombardi comes in at the end of the first half. Then Lewerke comes back in the fourth quarter, and Twitter kind of exploded with all of that, with basically a what the what. Should Lombardi have gotten that start?
Somebody should have, and should have stayed with him. You get these guys going in a revolving door situation, and now you got two head cases and not one. D'Antonio is a phenomenally good coach. He's gotten more out of less than probably anybody in the Big Ten, maybe in the nation.
Which you say every week.
I do, and not this week, because yeah. You've got two very good quarterbacks, I think, and they both look pretty unconfident right now. The old joke is, if you've got two quarterbacks, you don't have a quarterback, and right now it's where they are.
So what do you think should happen next up against Nebraska?
Lewerke is not healthy. He's not there yet. So tell Lombardi on Monday, today, that you are the guy, get the team behind him. I want all doubts out of his head. I want him to think that he's the man. Look, there are three guys in my life that I want to think are the best in the world. I don't care how cocky they are. My pilot, my brain surgeon, and either my starting quarterback or my starting goalie. You are the best who ever was. No doubts.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubakin. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Elton John had his Rocket Man. David Bowie sang about Major Tom in Space Oddity. But these two superstars have nothing on Drew Feustel's song, All Around the World.
16 times around and round, the sun comes up, the sun goes down on everybody's lives. The world goes fast as we float slow, the stars above, the earth below, we look down to see the sky.
Astronaut Drew Feustel recorded his song orbiting the Earth aboard the International Space Station. His mission lasted 197 days. It took him around the Earth 3,152 times. Dr. Feustel returned to Earth October 4th, and it's a sure bet he will have a lot of stories at the next reunion of the Lake Orion High School class of 1983. Dr. Drew Feustel, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today from Michigan.
Absolutely. And again, just to remind everybody, you grew up in Lake Orion. To your knowledge, are you the first astronaut to record a music video in space?
No, I think I'm actually the second astronaut. The first was Commander Chris Hadfield, Canadian astronaut, who flew back in, I think that was 2012. And Chris recorded the David Bowie song, Space Oddity. Up in space.
That's right. I do remember that now. Well, this was your song, though, wasn't it? All Around the World is your song?
I had some help from a band called The Tragically Hip, which is a Canadian band, and one particular member of that band, Gord Sinclair, the bassist and songwriter, he wrote the song, he wrote the music, and we talked early on about some collaboration, and I, the first time I heard it, I thought it was amazing. I thought it was, the words that came to my mind were hauntingly beautiful, and I don't know if it rings with anybody else, but it's just what I thought, and it was a great honor for me to sing that song that he brought together, and I thought it really did a good job of capturing sort of the pace of the way we see the Earth and the things that we think about while we're in space, and he did that all on his own just through discussions that we'd had together over the years.
It is. It is a hauntingly beautiful song and video as well. And so I kind of read up on your time on the International Space Station, I know it encompassed two expeditions, 55 and 56. And am I right that you commanded 56?
That's right. Expedition. So we launched in March. Expedition 55 ended in, I think it was early June, the beginning of June. So then Expedition 56 began at that time, and I took over as commander until the end in October.
And what were the goals of these expeditions?
Well, our intent is just to maintain permanent human presence in space in low Earth orbit on the International Space Station. It serves as an international laboratory for science and technology, both looking at science that's important for the Earth and people of the Earth, and also science and technology that's important to help us as humans learn to live off of the planet. So we continuously, we're the 56th expedition to be there, and Expedition 57 has already started. And so the goal is that with each new crew set that comes up, we just continue on the legacy of the previous crews. Humans have been living on the space station for 18 years now, since 2000, and we will continue to operate the space station in the way that we have with the continuation of the science, hopefully through 2028.
Hmm. I know your first mission to space was in 2009, so you are indeed a veteran. And am I correct, you've done 9 spacewalks through your career?
I've done 9 spacewalks. I was 5 hours and 57 minutes short of the U.S. spacewalking record, but alas, I missed the final opportunity. But yeah, 9 spacewalks, 3 on each of the missions that I've flown.
So over these years, so we're talking nearly a decade of going to space, has your feeling about being in space evolved or changed through these missions?
You know, that is a great question. I have been thinking about that myself recently, and I think I've become more aware of the vulnerability of the planet over these years, more aware of the disconnect between where I think we should be as a species and where we are with the challenges, you know, the cross-border challenges and the around-the-world challenges, both politically and social politically. So being in space has changed my view a bit, and I think at this point I have more of a desire to see more unity, and I'm thinking longer term, not just about my generation or the next, but the entire survival of the human species. And maybe it's altruistic to think that far out, and I've recently had some discussions with folks that were not in favor of human space exploration, but I do think it's important. I think the long-term view is important for us. And so I'd say that's how I've changed over the years.
And it has to just be, I mean, you're one of literally a handful of humans that can say that you have been able to circle the Earth from 50 miles up and get that sense of the Earth minus the man-made borders.
Yeah, from 250 miles up, we cannot see any borders at all. I mean, I'll tell you, the only borders we really see are the ones that we can identify at night when the lights are on across the world. That's really the only time that you might be able to make out delineations from one country to the next. But certainly in the daytime, or most of the time when we pass over the planet, we just don't see anything but dirt and green and ocean and just one planet that we all live on, one big round globe that we're all existing on. And you think constantly about the people down there, the people that you love, the people that you know, your friends and family, all the folks that supported you to get you into space. And it does have an impact on you.
I'm speaking with NASA astronaut Drew Feustel, who grew up in Lake Orion. He has recently returned to Earth after 6 months aboard the International Space Station. So when did the space bug bite you? What made you want to be an astronaut?
You know, it's hard for me to identify that. I grew up believing that I would one day work in the space industry, and I grew up watching science fiction, you know, television shows and movies, and always thought that would be an amazing place to work. Space would be an amazing place to work, and that space represented the forefront of technology, and space represented our, you know, the possibility for humans to explore the things that are off our planet. I mean, that's where all the neat stuff was happening, at least in my mind. I was very young when we went to the moon and followed, you know, as I grew up watching the development of the space shuttle program. And so I was always interested in space, and I'm still interested in space exploration. I still love science fiction movies. I think those are the things that inspire us to dream and set we might not otherwise think about. And that's one of the focuses that we have as astronauts, is to inspire the next generation of explorers for the youth of the world to think about all of the opportunities they have and to not hold back, to try to break those borders.
And in fact, speaking of your career path to space, I know that you earned your PhD in geological sciences, but your road to being a geophysicist and a NASA astronaut actually began at Oakland Community College?
That is correct. Yeah, you know, I didn't have the best grades coming out of high school, and my scores for ACT and SAT were not great. I think at the time I wasn't really focused and didn't have a good understanding of what it was going to take to get to where I needed to be. But OCC was a great start, allowed me to pursue a couple of different fields of interest. I started off as an industrial design artist or industrial design drawer. I thought maybe I wanted to be an automotive designer because I'm, you know, growing up in the Motor City, I was always into mechanics and automotive, had a lot of automotive interests. So I did that for a while at Oakland Community College, and then also had a degree in science. So I started looking at the field of geology and geosciences, and I realized I really liked that. So it was just a great start. It was a great start for me. I spent 3 years at OCC, received my associate science degree, but I was also working at the same time as a mechanic at a local shop in Farmington Hills restoring old cars.
That really is an affirmation of the paths that you have to take. And as you say, if your GPA isn't a top drawer or your SAT or ACT scores aren't great, it doesn't mean that you aren't going to have an amazing career.
And you can, as they said at OCC, you could get anywhere from here. And it really is true. I mean, for me, it was a matter of just having the opportunity to explore different career fields without the pressure of, you know, what university sometimes places on individuals. It's tough at university to make those changes. I know for our kids, there was some challenges with finding, you know, the right path while you're there. And there's a lot of pressure due to the money that you're spending at university to try to get it right from the start. And that's not really what I think some kids need. If you're not sure what you want to do, you know, community college offers a great place to start and feel those things out and try to get it right before you start making that big commitment.
Drew, so what was it like for you when you landed in October after 6 months? 6 months in the International Space Station. How'd the old muscles work?
I didn't feel great. I'll be honest. After 197 days in space, it really kind of takes its toll. And it's not that we don't land strong. We do, because we work out or exercise about 2.5 hours a day. But the reality is that the neurons don't fire the same way that they used to, because they just are out of practice. So it takes some time for us to sort of teach the muscles how to work again to support your body and get your feet moving so that you can walk a straight line. My gyros in my head were spinning a bit and I felt dizzy, but it after, you know, each hour I felt better and better and better. And then each day I felt better and better. Now each week I feel better and better. And I would say that I feel like I'm 100%, but I'm probably, in reality, I'm probably about 98%. But physically, I'm doing well, exercising every day, reconditioning, strength conditioning, and stretching just to make everything move the way that it did, 7 months ago before I launched into space.
And NASA's website has you listed still as an active astronaut. So what is ahead for you?
Absolutely. I don't know yet. Time will tell, and we like to take a little bit of time once we return from Earth on a long-duration mission just to sort things out. And I'll continue to support missions to space and other active astronauts who are getting ready to fly. I'll work as an instructor astronaut and support technical meetings within the office to make sure that those that are preparing to fly and those that are in space have what they need to support their livelihood and the science. And then also make sure we have prepared well enough to bring those folks back home. So we just continue along the process just like we have for the past 18 years of preparing people to fly, flying them in space, and making sure we bring them back safely.
NASA astronaut and Michigan's home son, Drew Feustel, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside, and congratulations on your mission.
My pleasure. Thanks for your time today, and a big shout out to all my friends and family in Michigan, and I look forward to seeing you all soon.
Coming up, an advocate for sexual assault survivors shares her concerns over pending changes to Title IX by the Department of Education.
What DeVos's new rules are looking to do is let schools off the hook for covering up cases of sexual misconduct, to let schools off the hook for continuously sweeping sexual assault under the rug.
We will have that conversation in 5 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The 100th anniversary of the end of World War I added new, powerful dimensions to this year's Veterans Day observances. At the Great Lakes National Cemetery in northern Oakland County, every single day is Veterans Day. It's one of two national cemeteries in Michigan, the other being Fort Custer near Battle Creek. Sean Baumgartner is director of the Great Lakes National Cemetery in Holly. Sean, how many veterans are resting there?
We have approximately a little over 38,000 interments.
And that's veterans and family members?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
So to get a sense of what your mission is, are you essentially like Arlington National Cemetery, if people are familiar with that, only you're here in Southeast Michigan?
Yeah, if you had to put a picture on it, yeah, that's what we do. And we have our own little Arlington, if you will, in the backyard in Michigan and Holly. It's beautiful.
And when you think of these veterans resting at Great Lakes, how far back in our history have they served? I have been to services there of some of the World War II veterans that I went with on honor flights. Do you go back to World War I or even earlier?
Well, since we're a newer cemetery, we opened up in 2005, so there's not a lot of old history per se, but we do have a lot of World War II as our majority, you know, Vietnam, Korea.
And what is a burial service like at Great Lakes?
Well, when they pull up to the main administration building, they're greeted by a cemetery representative who will escort the cortege to what we call our committal shelters. And with the committal shelters, that's where the final respects are given. It's kind of like a little service to say goodbye. And that's where military funeral honors are rendered. That includes, the flag folding, taps, and rifle volleys. And then the flag is presented to the next of kin. And then if the next of kin chooses, they can bring clergy, or if they'd like to speak a few minutes, just to give tribute to that veteran or that family member. After that service, the caretakers will take the veteran or the family member to their final resting place.
And I know earlier today, there was an unaccompanied veterans ceremony where you laid to rest veterans whose remains were uncovered or discovered at the Cantrell Funeral Home in Detroit. How many veterans were honored in that ceremony today?
17.
Is that ceremony at all different from services with vets who have family members? What happens during the unaccompanied vets ceremony?
Well, it's a little bit different, but thanks to Brian Johnson, he's the funeral director that's been helping out and making all the arrangements here, but he's really made an effort to try to contact next of kin for these veterans, and it's different in the fact that, these guys have been forgotten, but now they're not, we get to honor them the proper way that they need to be honored, and to honor them for their service and to lay them to rest with dignity as well, too. So now, in perpetuity, they'll be with their brothers and sisters in arms, well taken care of.
Sean, what do you feel is your mission every day when you come to work and you set foot on the Great Lakes National Cemetery?
Wow, that's a deep question. A lot of things. I get the privilege and the honor of helping people in the most hurtful and just trying time of life, that we get to make a difference in their life by honoring their loved one and their family member, and that we get to inter their loved one. And to me, it's a trust. The family places their trust in us and me as a cemetery to take care of them, and that is a huge responsibility, but it is such an honor, and we're so grateful to do it. And we owe our veterans more than, we could ever repay them. And this is just one small way that we can give back to those families to assure them that we're going to take care of their loved one in perpetuity. What a great responsibility.
Sean Baumgartner is the director of the Great Lakes National Cemetery in Oakland County in Holly. It is one of two national cemeteries in Michigan. Sean, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you, ma'am.
The Believed podcast tells the story of how disgraced sports doctor Larry Nassar got away with his abuse for so long. This week, reporters Lindsay Smith and Kate Wells bring you Nassar in his own words. It's 2014. MSU grad student Amanda Thomashow tells MSU Nassar sexually assaulted her during an appointment. And Nassar is called into the Michigan State University police station for an interview. Here is a clip from Believed, Episode 4, Gaslighting.
Larry Nassar is inside the police department at Michigan State University. Detective Valerie O'Brien walks him into a bland, gray interview room.
It's okay if I turn on my computer. It takes a while to warm up.
Oh, yeah, not a problem.
She apologizes. It's a little cramped.
At any time you feel you want to get the heck out of here, you can get out, walk out. My feelings won't be hurt, okay? So I guess what I'm looking for is...
Larry tells Detective O'Brien he has been waiting for her call. The university put him on leave after Amanda's complaint. He seems relieved to be here, like he is finally getting a chance to sort out a terrible misunderstanding.
What I was told was that the patient was concerned that I was inappropriately touching her and didn't understand why. And those are two things that confuse me, because I do this on a regular basis. This is a treatment that I...
As you hear Larry describe his version of what happened on that grainy police video, we're going to weave in the other version, Amanda's, as she told it to us.
It was supposed to be a quick appointment.
We want you to hear Larry and Amanda's stories side by side.
30 minutes is the quickest appointment that you're going to have with me.
But... it was like a 2-hour, 3-hour appointment.
It's 30 to 60 minutes, okay? Because I do a lot of hands-on and I do a lot of mentoring. You know, I do a lot of talking.
Listening this way, you can hear for yourself how Larry gets people to believe him, not Amanda. How he constructs an alternate reality where he's not abusing these girls, he's healing them.
To be able to do this stuff, and to be able to do this stuff for so long, if you don't have patient confidence and patient trust, you would have been having my ass in here how many times?
Right.
Okay, especially when I'm doing this on 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, okay, with their parents there. But I'm obviously doing a doggone good job explaining things, okay, because what?
New episodes of Believed drop every Monday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. MSU police were not the only ones looking into Amanda Thomashow's complaint against Larry Nassar. MSU's Title IX office also launched an investigation. And how universities like MSU handle sexual assault investigations could soon be changing. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is expected to release new federal rules on Title IX investigations. Dozens of survivors who say they were sexually assaulted by Nassar and two other university physicians recently sent a letter to DeVos asking her to reconsider the proposed changes. Sage Carson is with us now via Skype. She is a sexual assault survivor and a manager at Know Your Nine, a survivor and youth-led project working to help young people end sexual and dating violence in their schools. Sage Carson, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me today.
So to help us understand the changes the secretary will soon announce, it's expected, could you briefly walk us through the existing process, the way schools investigate sexual assault allegations under Title IX? You know, who's responsible? To whom do students report the allegation? What's the process?
So the process looks different on different campuses, especially depending on the size. But what we generally see is that if someone is looking to seek support from their school, they'll go and they can tell an RA or a professor, and that professor or RA can connect them with their Title IX coordinator, who will send them resources and accommodations and let them know what the process is on campus. After they do that, the student can choose to either go through an informal process or a formal process. So the informal process would mean that maybe they're just looking for extensions on a paper, or they're looking for access to counseling, because after you've experienced sexual violence, the trauma can make it very hard to engage in education. If a student decides to go through the formal investigation, what we generally see is either a school having investigators that are meeting with the complainant or the survivor and the respondent or the accused, and then either the investigators will make a recommendation to a committee on if they find the person responsible or not, or the two parties may have to come before a hearing panel to answer questions about the alleged incidents. And from that, the school will make a finding, and then they will also issue sanctions. So a student could maybe just be told to take a semester off, or maybe have to transfer to a different dorm or a different classroom, all the way up to possible expulsion.
Okay. And from the much, there's been a lot of reporting done on these proposed changes over the past year. And it seems that what we're hearing is Secretary DeVos would narrow the scope of sexual assault complaints that schools are required to investigate, also allow the accused to cross-examine the accuser. What do you think these changes, which DeVos calls a more balanced approach, could mean for those who are accusing someone?
So there's a lot of concerns with what we've seen of her new proposed rules, and you highlighted two very concerning ones. One, the changing of the definition of sexual harassment or sexual violence, which would mean that my harassment or the harassment I'm experiencing would have to be so severe that I've already dropped my class, or I've already stopped going to class entirely. It would have to reach that level before a school would investigate. And that's obviously a very high bar to reach. And the purpose of Title IX is supposed to be to ensure equal access to education. So they should be providing remedies before it gets to that level. Also the concern of direct cross-examination. Mm-hmm. So typically, if a school is doing cross-examination, they are doing it through a neutral third party. This is a very common practice to use a neutral third party because someone may choose to intimidate or harass someone when going through the investigative process if they can directly question them. What DeVos is asking for is for there to be direct cross-examination, meaning the respondent would be directly asking the survivor about the assault or the abuse. This is a very unfair process, and actually was even raised that it would be an unfair process in the recent Sixth Circuit decision on cross-examination in schools, where the court said that while cross-examination is very important, direct cross-examination is an undue burden on survivors and will create additional trauma. I know for myself as a survivor, when I was going through my campus process, I didn't know until like 3 days before that I would be directly cross-examined by my abuser. And because of that, I ended up dropping my case. And I've spoken to survivors across the country that experienced the same thing. As soon as they were told that their abuser was going to be asking them questions about the rape, they couldn't move forward with the case because it was so terrifying to them.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Sage Carson, who is with Know Your Nine, a survivor and youth-led project helping to end sexual and dating violence in schools, as we talk about possible changes coming from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to the way that colleges and universities would investigate allegations of sexual assault. And you referred to the case, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, in October. It affirmed the lower court's ruling that the University of Michigan needs to make major changes to how it handles Title IX investigations. Deborah Gordon is the attorney representing that former U of M student involved in the case against the university. And we talked with her last year, and at that time she told us universities should treat sexual assault cases the very same way they treat other issues of student safety.
Am I safe walking across campus if somebody stops me and robs me, another student? Is that a safety issue? Oh, yes, it is. But if I complain about the robbery, the guy I say robbed me gets a due process hearing. That's how they need to deal with it. They need to search for the truth.
So Gordon's arguing that you need to have that direct cross-examination in these student discipline cases involving sexual assault in order to have due process, to allow the accused to defend himself or herself, to present his or her side. How do you respond to that?
I think that there's been a lot of concern around due process and fair process. And we at Know Your Nine are deeply, deeply concerned with fair process for students. But what we always want to call attention to when we're talking about fair process is fair process for whom? Survivors and the people complaining about the violence that they've experienced are the ones that are usually entering the most unfair system. An example of this would be when I was a student, I was told that the hearing panel that would be hearing this was made up all of my rapist teachers. None of my teachers would be present, but his teachers would, so that they can make a decision on how he should be held accountable. That is obviously an unfair and very unbalanced system for me, for some people that are connected to him, that work with him deeply, and are really, really invested in him staying at the school to be the only people making a decision about whether he should stay or leave. We do believe that cross-examination is essential and important. We do not agree that direct cross-examination is the way to do it. Using a neutral third party is a fair and equal process. It allows both parties to submit questions. It allows both parties to engage with the process fully, and it doesn't place the unfair burden on survivors to be directly questioned by the person that assaulted them.
And what are your thoughts on the projected narrowing of the scope of sexual assault complaints that schools would have to investigate?
So one way that DeVos is narrowing the scope is through only covering or only allowing schools to cover assaults that occur on campus. This is very alarming because most students live off campus. It's been found that over 80% of students do not live in on-campus housing, as well as Title IX applies to K-12 students as well. And most K-12 students are spending a lot of time at home, are spending time with their friends. And we know that when violence is occurring, it's largely occurring off campus. So this would really narrow who is able to seek resources under Title IX. The point of Title IX is supposed to be to remedy violence that has occurred and to remedy someone's able to engage in education. My experience with sexual violence, my ability to sit in a lecture, my ability to take my test, my ability to go to after-school activities did not change whether I was assaulted in a dorm or down the street. I myself was assaulted off campus in an apartment, but I still had to share a classroom with the people that assaulted me. And because of that, I feared going to class every day, and I often would not leave my home. So this really shows us that Betsy DeVos doesn't understand the purpose of Title IX, which is to fix a hostile environment that has occurred, to make sure someone can engage in their education. Because again, it doesn't change if I was assaulted in the bathroom or if I was assaulted at a bar across the street or a fraternity house.
What do you have your eye on as we wait for these proposed rules to be released? And I know that we've been kind of waiting a while. We've been hearing they're coming. What do you have your eye on?
I think what we're really looking to see is, who is Betsy DeVos looking to discriminate against? Is she looking to push forward these off-campus pieces where if someone is assaulted off-campus, they don't have rights under Title IX? We're also looking to see how much she is looking to let schools off the hook. We're hearing a lot of the media's coverage about her proposed rules, highlighting that they're saying it gives more of a fair process, and it gives respondents more rights. From what we've seen of the leaked rules, that's simply not true. What DeVos's new rules are looking to do is let schools off the hook for covering up cases of sexual misconduct, to let schools off the hook for continuously sweeping sexual assault under the rug, and to roll us back to before the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, when students were continually told to drop out, were kicked off of campus for reporting sexual misconduct, or dropped out entirely. If she was fully interested in making a fair process for everyone, she would be meeting with survivors' rights groups. She would be meeting with civil rights groups, and she has not been. She had a single meeting with survivors a year ago and has never spoken with survivors since. And so we don't truly believe that she is interested in a fair process. We think she is interested in letting schools off the hook and saving them money.
Sage Carson is a sexual assault survivor who is a manager at Know Your Nine, a project that works to help end sexual and dating violence at schools. Sage, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.